They had, I think they did have motion detectors, but we weren't concerned about that. I could have shut off the alarm in the front of the building, but there was too much traffic. So I just figured we'd just go through the roof.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there. We're here in the classic old Ice House building with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, wiretappers, we're going to try something new tonight. We're starting off a three or maybe four episode series. We haven't got them all, in the bag yet. Or I haven't got all the scripts written and all the interviews recorded. We hope all you guys would like this new format. I call it Gangland Wire, the big score. We're going to take different caper kind of crimes and take a look at them. If we can't get the original participant in some of these events, which many of them we can't because they're dead or they're impossible to find. They're in the witness protection program or, we just can't find them. We're going to use actors. So let's give some credit to our actors. Ben Ellickson of Chicago. Local comedian, Kojak of Kansas City, and the man of a thousand voices, and also the co-host of the Big Dumb Fun Show, Alex Virgo of Kansas City. Now, every good thief wants that one big score. How many movies have you guys listened to when it was about that one big score, about that last score before the master thief retires? I don't know how many of them there are out there. The first one I remember seeing was probably the Thomas Crown Affair. And there have been plenty since that time. There was Heat, there was Heist, there was Ocean's 11, 12, Ocean's 8 with the all-female cast. What's your favorite caper film? Aaron, do you have a favorite caper film that you can think of?
You know, I like James Caan and Thief.
Thief, oh yeah, Thief's a good one. He was he did a couple capers in that. It started off with a caper that was a little bit like the caper we're going to start talking about tonight, the hole-in-the-wall gang, Bertha's Gift Shop. All you wiretappers out there, why don't you name off your favorite caper film and send them to me via the website or Facebook page, Gangland Wire Facebook page. Let me know what's your favorite. Put up a link to your favorite caper film. Play that little clip. Let's see if anybody recognizes this particular caper film.
Our problem is take the bank or split right now. Do not go home. Do not pack. Nothing. 30 seconds flat from now, we are gone on our separate ways. That's it.
Bank is worth the risk. I need it, brother. You should stay and take it down. That's where I come out.
I roll with you, Neil, whatever.
Cool. Yeah, sure. Let's go.
Fuck them. Let's do it.
All right. All you guys, if you can name that film, and I know you probably can, why, hit us up there on the website or Facebook page. Well, Aaron, let's get started telling this story. You have anything else you want to say before we get started, Aaron?
Well, I got to tell folks is go back and listen to the two-episode interview with Frank Ulotta. It's going to give you a lot of background on this teleplay, so to speak,
yeah,
from the mouth of the men that did it.
It will. To reiterate, Aaron and I are going to examine individual criminal conspiracies that people participated in to commit a specific crime, not just random crimes. You know, lots of times we just talk about random crimes these mob guys do. They extort money, they loan shark, they do gambling and all that kind of thing. But we're talking about groups of men that get together to do a specific crime. This particular crime we're going to look at tonight is the 1981 burglary of Bertha's Gifts and Home Furnishings. It was located at 896 East Sahara Street in Las Vegas. And I think that still exists, although it's not Bertha's anymore. Bertha Ragland, I was always curious about who was Bertha. And Bertha Ragland came to Las Vegas right after World War II. as a lot of people did, and she opened a fine china and home furnishing store, kind of a little Western dump back then. She would end up eventually adding a high-end jewelry store inside the home furnishing store. She was Bertha Ragland was a real colorful, well-known Las Vegas businesswoman, and became extremely successful. All the wealthy people, when they made money, or the gamblers, when they made money, they went to Bertha's to buy their jewelry. They wanted to furnish that new house that they built out on around the golf course. They went to Bertha's for furnishings for it, and they wanted some china. They went to Bertha's. That was the place to go for people in Las Vegas.
And they were down on their luck, and they needed to get a little extra cash.
They could probably go in there and get some money to Bertha's if they had jewelry.
All I got is this watch.
Right.
It's a nice watch.
All I got, this gold necklace. I can get some money out of that and hit the casinos again. And remember, this was over 30 years ago, and credit cards were used back then, but in Las Vegas, people mainly dealt in cash at that point in time. The CTR, or the cash transaction report, was not widely used and mainly ignored by financial institutions until the later 80s during the crack wars, and DEA got really tough on money laundering. But back then, a lot of people didn't use it. And what that cash transaction report is, that if a bank or a business has any kind of a transaction in $10,000 or more in cash, they have to fill out a report. And then when they fill it out, they can even have a place to mark a suspicious transaction on it. So I think that's one of the things that some of these Trump people are going to be in trouble for, that some suspicious transactions that got through.
That they didn't mark as suspicious?
Right.
We're not sure about this one, so we're just going to go ahead and mark it as suspicious.
or it was suspicious, we didn't mark it. I don't know which.
Bertha Ragland wasn't stupid.
Yeah, she didn't even have to fill them out. They didn't even fill them out back then. But anyhow, she didn't. It was a well-known fact to her employees that she didn't really trust banks, and she kept large, and plus she needed to keep large amounts of cash inside the safe if she wanted to buy some jewelry from down-on-the-luck gamblers, and kept her jewelry inside the safe in the store. A lot of people knew about that. Now, to take you back, I want to set the scene. What was Las Vegas like, law enforcement, and what was going on in the 1970s and 1980s? If you guys from Chicago, you remember Jane Byrne? She was the mayor of Chicago. Back in 1981, Mayor Jane Byrne moved her family into the Cabrini Green high-rise housing project for 3 whole weeks. And half the Chicago Police Department was surrounding that project during those 3 weeks. 1981, there was a groundbreaking cop show, one of the first ones that was really realistic, Hill Street Blues. I bet a lot of y'all remembered that. I loved that show. I remember J.D. LaRue said, asked him to have a drink, and he had to quit drinking because he was in so much trouble. And they said, oh, just have one, just a social drink. And he said, ma'am, I've never had a social drink in my life. So I understand that thought process. I've never had a social drink in my life either.
I've never had a professional drink in my life. I'm not a professional drinker.
I've had a few of those. I was watching the, during that time in the 80s, I was watching the Kansas City Mob Boys, and they were trying to regain some organization after the skimming search warrants were served in 1979, and Joe Augusto had turned government witness. Now, we won't go all the way back into the skim, but just in the middle to later 70s, Kansas City, Chicago, and Milwaukee and Cleveland all were getting skim money out of Las Vegas, and it all got exposed. Just watch the movie Casino, and you'll see a lot about that, or rent my movie, Gangland Wire. It'll tell you all about that. Now, I'm in Chicago, 1981. Anthony Accardo acted like he was the kind of the advisor, but he was a real power behind the throne of the Chicago outfit. Joey Iupa, Joey Doves, was the boss to all the outside observers, to all the people on the street. Joey Iupa was the boss, but he didn't do anything without getting Accardo's permission, is my understanding. During these years After the search warrants were served, the FBI was continuing a multi-prong attack on the outfit in Chicago and Kansas City, but primarily in Chicago because it's so big up there. And they wanted to expose all their connections to Teamsters unions and the Las Vegas casinos. And that's what Strawman did, the skimming investigation. They had the Operation Pindorf. The FBI taped Teamsters official Alan Dorfman plotting to skim Teamsters money with outfit capo Joey the Clown Lombardo and others. They had Operation Greylord and Operation Gambit, and this uncovered and identified the outfit's penetration of the Cook County Circuit Court and other Cook County government entities, probably the most corrupt city and county in the United States, even more than New York.
Well, if you're going to get away with crime, you don't want to let the law get in the way. And so having a judge on your side, or maybe a few corrupt police officers to kind of taint the evidence or look the other way.
Yeah, or bribe witnesses. They did it all up there. Bribe jurors. They did it all up there. You know, if we remember the Al Capone story we did about the interview of the juror, the Al Capone juror, that article I found in an old newspaper, this guy told the inside story on the jury. And what they had to do is Al Capone had the jury paid off that he thought he was going to get. And the judge and the prosecutor knew that he had that already done. And at the last minute, they bring the prosecution and defendant all come in. And before they bring the jury in, and the judge says, wait a minute. He said, before we get started here, bailiff, he said, take this jury here down to division, whatever, 4, and bring that jury up and let them hear this trial. And this jury will hear that trial. And I guess Al Capone's lawyers, they just like melted in their chairs because they already had, they didn't have time to go try to find a weak sister in the new jury. And they convicted him. So that's, I mean, that's Chicago. And Chicago was like that all the way up into the 80s. It may still be a little bit like that, but it was like that all the way up in the 80s.
Don't they, what happened to, was it Vordire?
Vordire.
Where you get a, you know, kind of the prosecutor or the defense attorney both get to kind of question this jury that gets as part of the jury selection process.
Well, sure, you can do that, but
and then the judge changes the jury. I didn't select this jury. This is they didn't argue that was an unfair move on the judge's part.
Well, you probably just put them through Vore Dire again. You ask your question. Vore Dire was not such a big deal.
Obviously not.
But you know, you could just conduct.
How would you feel if you were trying a case and they also just totally switched out a jury on you?
It would depend. I'm not sure.
If you were Al Capone's attorney, you'd be a little upset.
Yeah, but you're getting into legal morass here. More than likely, they hadn't even done Vore Dire yet. They just had the panel ready to go. And they still had to do Vore Dire. They could have done that, or they could have done Vore Dire, but they could have then brought the next jury in and done Vore Dire on them too.
Well,
and they would have had some alternates, so then they could select some people in. They just needed some people that didn't know they were going to be on that jury till the last minute.
Yeah, that was the last good year for Al Capone.
It was.
And in 1981 was the last good year for the Chicago outfit.
Yep. There's a burglary in the Las Vegas store named Bertha's Gifts and Furnishings, as I said before. And out of that burglary is going to come one of the most important witnesses against the outfit in the history of the outfit, Frank Culotta. And as Aaron said at the start, you know, go back and listen to our 2 episodes interviewing Frank Culotta. You're going to hear some repeats in the story we're going to tell, of course, as he talked a little bit about this, but it'll give you the complete overview of what was going on in and around that, and a lot of things that we won't talk about, because we're going to be narrowly focused on the crime itself and the build up to the crime. So let's look at this relationship that is going to start a long time ago and is going to end after the big score at Bertha's. Look back to the early 1960s in Chicago. There's a young thief named Frank Culotta. He's become friends with a guy named Tony Spilotro. One thing they did, they were shoeshine boys on the same block, and they got in an argument, and Frank Culotta said Tony Culotta went to his dad or his uncle and asked who this guy was, this Culotta. And he said, you know, that's Tony Culotta. I can't remember the dad's name, but that's so-and-so Culotta's son. They're okay. And so they started being friends back then. But later on, when they're 23 years old, Frank Culotta used a friendship he had with one of his other fall partners. And the fall partner's a guy that's done crime with you. One of his fall partners, a young thief named Billy McCarthy. The outfit wanted Billy McCarthy, and they wanted his partner, Billy Maraglia. So as a favor for the outfit and for Tony Spilotro in particular, Frank lured Billy McCarthy into a spot where he could be kidnapped. He was handed over to Spilotro to torture and murder. Now, if you saw that scene in the very first scene of Casino where he's got that guy's head in the vice, that was Billy McCarthy trying to get him to give up the name of his buddy on those burglaries, Billy Maraglia, and he did. Frank Galata would say that Spilotro told him, said, yeah, about that cranking the vice down in the guy's head, and that just, he said, just as the guy's eye popped out, he told me the name, and then we went ahead and killed him. So these are some cruel, cold dudes up there. I asked Frank Calabrese, I said, what's it up with you Chicago dudes? You're always wanting to torture people. Sam DiStefano and that killing of that William Axon Jackson. I mean, they tortured that poor guy for 2 or 3 days before they killed him. I don't know what's up with those guys up there.
Yeah, when your name is The Hook, LaPietra.
Angelo LaPietra, The Hook, because he used to hang people up on a meat hook.
Yeah, and puncture their lung, and they would... They would actually suffocate, which is horrible to think about. They wouldn't just freeze hanging there. It wouldn't be the pain of the meat hook. It'd be the fact that this punctured lung would cause them to suffocate while he's using a blowtorch on them.
Really? They're crazy up there.
Man. Well, yeah, and I thought the other thing that's interesting that Frank talked about in that two-part episode you want to go back and listen to is that when they were filming that scene, they had it wrong, and they had him, I thought, face up in the vice.
Oh, yeah.
And he was, in fact, actually face down.
Face down, yeah. Kind of detail I don't really need to know.
Yeah.
Well,
makes
up at night.
Makes a lot more sense for the eye popping out.
Yeah, really.
To me. But, you know.
Anyhow, moving right along. During the 1960s, Tony Spilotro and Frank Galata partnered on several really nice burglary scores. One of the early ones was a really good score, a 1957 bank job. And you know, the Hole in the Wall gang got its name because they would knock a hole in the wall and go in order to avoid the alarms on the doors and the windows. This is kind of before they had metal or, what do you call those things? Aaron had those motion detectors. And Frank talked about that in the interview before, the motion detectors and whether they had them or not. But in 1957, they broke through the wall of a basement in the bank. They did it early on a weekend, so they would have a couple of days after they got in and get back out and get clear away, because the bank would be closed, you know, all day Sunday and usually Saturday afternoon, Saturday night. They used sledgehammers, acetylene torches, and other heavy equipment tools. Frank netted out of that. In 1957, Frank would say that he netted $50,000 for his end of that score. That's a lot of money in 1957. That's like, I don't know, what would you say that would be like? A couple hundred thousand dollars today?
Probably more than that, because in 57, you got to think that was like, you know, 60 years ago.
Yeah,
so
I wasn't even in high school yet.
You know what that would be?
I was working for a dollar an hour, probably.
That'd be a nice haul for the weekend.
Nice haul for the weekend. And that's just his end of it. I don't know what the whole total score was. Frank will continue to use these same techniques until his very last burglary at Bertha's in 1981. And Tony was involved with that. But by that time, Tony had kind of moved on up in the mob hierarchy. So he would get a piece of the action, but he was not going to be part of the crew that was down on the ground.
Wouldn't a crew normally only get maybe 10% each? So that's probably $500,000 score or more at the time. Just guessing, saying they'd net out because they still had to, you know, they had to wet the beak above them.
They had to pay the outfit off. Yeah, they did. I don't know. I don't know what the total end of it was. Yeah. Endless speculation. We can go down that path, but probably better not. People get bored with that. You know, I ask you, how did these two Chicago thieves, Chicago outfit members, end up burglarizing a gift shop in 1981 Las Vegas? What were Chicago mobsters doing out there in Las Vegas? This is UNLV Professor Michael Green, who is a mob expert and an expert on Nevada history, especially in the more recent history, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
The Tropicana opened in 1957 as a Frank Costello operation. Just a few weeks after it opened, Costello gets shot in New York, and in his pocket is a piece of paper with the take at the Tropicana that they were reporting to the state. Supposedly, there was a treaty, for lack of a better term, an organized crime treaty when Atlantic City made gambling legal. And the New York families and Meyer Lansky said, we'll take the East and the Midwest can have Las Vegas. So Chicago, Kansas City, and Milwaukee really get themselves into Las Vegas more deeply than they had been in the past.
Now you understand how the outfit ended up in the Las Vegas casino business. It was kind of a long, slow, but sure move out there, especially in the later 60s into the 70s. In preparation for this, in 1971, a Chicago outfit associate and well-known gambler and odds maker, but he moved to Vegas and got a job at the Stardust. And I think he was told to do that. I don't know for sure. I've looked at his FBI file, and they just say that he's moved from Las Vegas, and the FBI paid special attention to him. As a matter of fact, they indicated in that they may want to try to talk to him again, which will come into play later on. And as we learn way later on that he becomes a top echelon informant, I think he probably had done some informing down in Florida, and then they cut him off because he was too hard to control. But anyhow, in 1971, after...
Well, by too hard to control, what you mean is he was still participating in illegal activities,
right,
that made them kind of question their relationship.
Exactly. Later in 1971, a 33-year-old Chicago outfit member that we talked about before, Anthony Tony Spilotro, moves out to Las Vegas with his wife. Matter of fact, I understand that Lefty and Jerry Rosenthal met him and kind of introduced him around and helped him buy a house and really was seen out in public with Spilotro, because at that time, Nevada authorities didn't really know who Lefty Rosenthal was or Tony Spilotro was, and they didn't know that Chicago was making a move on Las Vegas at this point in time. And Iupa wanted, he sent him out. Joey Iupa sent Spilotro out because he wanted a real close outfit member to watch Rosenthal and watch Rosenthal's back and take care of any problems that might come up, do any heavy work. I think right after he got out there, there was some woman that was threatening a lawsuit against the owner of the Stardust, Alan Glick, and Tamara Rand, I think was her name, and she ends up dead shortly after Spilotro got out there, shot in the head with a .22, which is kind of a classic Chicago deal. If they don't cut your throat and pull your tongue through your mouth.
Or strangle you with a Calabrese necktie.
Yeah, strangle you. That's what I was thinking of. The Calabrese necktie, strangle you.
At least they didn't
cut your throat.
Put her in a vise.
They didn't put her in a vise. They just popped her like they did Sam Giancana.
Here's what you're telling me, Gary, is Iupa sends Tony Spilotro out to cover the back of Lefty Rosenthal. Why was that?
Because he didn't want Lefty to have to go out, and Lefty really wasn't capable of doing any kind of strong arm work. He was helping run the casino. They needed him to move up into the casino and set up the skim and get the skim started. And like if you had a casino employee that was stealing from you, he could get hold of Spilotro and say, hey, do something about this guy. If you had a casino employee that maybe knew a little too much, you could have Spilotro get hold of the guy and do something, you know, maybe just intimidate him or maybe kill him. Then they had this Tamara Rand that had filed a lawsuit against the owner of the Stardust, Alan Glick, who was really a straw man for the Chicago outfit. And she ends up dead. Now, it was never proven that Spilotro did it, but he was sent out there to take care of that kind of business.
Did he have any kind of cover while he was out there? He's just like, I'm just the muscle guy, show up and kill people.
Yeah, and actually, as it came out, he had to get somebody else to do some of that stuff, but as it came out who he was. But yeah, he got a deal with the Circus Circus. Now, the Circus Circus was owned by a guy named Jay Sarno, and Jay Sarno had got a big Teamsters loan to buy that place, so he was already kicking back to Alan Dorfman and the Chicago outfit for his Circus Circus loan, and Tony opened up a gift shop as a front business. You know, interesting thing about the Circus Circus is they had an actual small circus inside the kind of the lobby area of the casino. I saw it once. It's kind of a crazy deal. It was set up for families, and it was the first casino that was set up to attract just families. Now everything's kind of more family oriented out there, believe it or not.
Yeah. Hey, you kids, go watch the elephants. I'm going to go lose our life savings.
Really?
But still, it was because they had gotten a Teamsters loan to build the Circus Circus. I didn't know that. That was another one of the casinos that then they had their hooks into.
Right. Exactly. That was, eventually some of that started coming out, and that Jay Sarno, the gaming commission, made him sell it. Kind of to show you what was going on at this point in time at the Circus Circus. Play that little clip of Carl Thomas telling, Carl Thomas was a Mob Connected casino employee at the Circus Circus who will eventually work for the Tropicana. And he was owned by the Kansas City family. And he's going to tell Nick Savella in this clip a story about skimming from the Circus Circus, which had been during this time.
I remember one night at Circus Circus, we had an obligation to meet. When I was younger, I had to involve myself. There was two guys that stayed outside. Bobby was one of them. And I was in out of my pocket back snatching that money. They weren't far from me to that refrigerator, putting money in my pocket. Too. I think if you do things out in the open, you stare a guy right in the face, the guy won't think he's doing nothing.
The most obvious is the best way.
Well, did you catch that at the end? That was Nick Savella saying, yeah, the most obvious way is the best way. You're going to steal. Well, 1974, as we talked about earlier, the Chicago outfit, the Kansas City crime family, the Milwaukee family, and the Chicago mob organization had pooled all their Teamsters union contacts together and paved the way for a 32-year-old, mild-mannered, balding, former Vietnam helicopter pilot who has turned small-time real estate developer into a guy that can get a $62 million loan from the Teamsters. Central States Teamsters Pension Fund. That's Alan Glick. Alan Glick created the Argent Corporation, which is kind of a combination of his initials, Alan R. Glick. And he purchased the Stardust, the Hacienda, the Fremont, and the Marina casinos. Now, he was told in return he needed to promote a current Stardust employee named Frank Rosenthal to a high-level job in his organization. Here's a little clip of a reenactment of Alan Glick's testimony about his dealings with Lefty Rosenthal.
There were several events that happened preceding to my purchase of the hotels that gave me an uncomfortable feeling about Mr. Frank Ballesteri. For example, I received a call from Mr. Ballesteri the second week of September in 74 in which he asked me to promote a Stardust employee named Frank Rosenthal to an executive position. I later spoke to the chairman of the Nevada Gaming Control Board and learned that Mr. Rosenthal was a highly respected individual in the gaming field. I was told he had a grasp of numbers and he understood the gaming concept and the different games which are housed in the casinos as well as anyone in Nevada. I also learned that he was an expert in sports handicapping and race operations. This same individual said the state would frown on Mr. Rosenthal being elevated to a position of authority over gaming, and he would not be licensed as a key employee. After this, I meet with Mr. Rosenthal, and I advised him he would be appointed as my assistant to advise me on gaming matters, and that he would have no control over casino operations. Mr. Rosenthal advised me that that would not work. And he demanded that I grant him full authority over all casino operations, or I would not leave this corporation alive.
Well, you won't leave this corporation alive. And not only that, they also flew him back to Kansas City, and Nick Savella threatened him when he didn't sell out the casino quick enough. But anyhow, I digress. Y'all remember the Robert De Niro character, Ace Rothstein, in the Scorsese film Casino? Well, that was a screenwriter, Nicholas Pledge's depiction of Frank Lefty Rosenthal. And that the fictional Ace Rothstein was a really accurate description of the real Lefty, who people in person, like Mike Green from the UNLV professor, he said his dad worked for under Lefty, and he said, just like everybody else says, that he was an arrogant, egotistical, ostentatious, flamboyant, and conspicuous gambler. He was exacting. If you remember the little scene in the casino movie where he's counting the number of blueberries and the blueberry muffins, and the guy had either not put in enough or put in too many, and he said, I want seven blueberries in each blueberry muffin, no more and no less. And he was that kind of guy. He would line casino employees up and berate them, and then maybe just pick one arbitrarily and fire them. That was his management concept. But this was,
well, I thought he was kind of, they, you know, as much as he maybe had Tony Spilotro's muscle, he was kind of feared himself.
He was. I interviewed a woman that worked for him out there, and she liked him. And she said, you know, she said he was the kind of guy, he was pretty quiet, but if he said something, you know, he meant it.
Sure, the casino was Frank Rosenthal, Joey Cusimano, Gene Cimarelli, Art Garelli. You know, it was just the whole gang going through the casino because they always went into the Moby Dick to eat. So I happened to be there that evening because I think we had a slot tournament going on or something to that effect. And I went walking by, and Mr. Rosenthal said, good evening, Lynn. You know, he had that very low voice. I said, good evening, Mr. Rosenthal. And I kind of walked by, and I heard his voice say, Lynn, come here. He says, you're not feeling good tonight? I said, no. I said, I'm feeling okay. I said, but, you know, I really had a bad situation today. I said, you know, Mr. Glick called me up to his office. He said he did. He says, follow me. So here's me with all these guys going into the Moby Dick. So we sit down, I sit next to Frank, and he says to the maitre d', bring me that phone. And I guess Alan had gone back to La Jolla, because that's where his family was. So I remember Frank picking up the phone and getting a hold of Alan, and from my side of it, he just basically said, good evening, Alan, how are you? You know, he said, listen, we have a little problem here. He said, you know, Lynn told me that, you know, you were very displeased that she went to San Diego without your permission or anybody's permission to edit my show. He said, and then she told me that, you know, you had said if it happened again that you were going to fire her. He says, I think we need to get something straight here, Alan. He says, you work for me. I run this show, and if you ever say anything to Lynn again, he says, I'm going to break both your legs. Have a good evening, Alan. And that was it. I never got bothered by him ever again.
And he was during this time in the early 70s. He started out in 71. This is around 74. The Midwest mob families are ready to move. They want to start getting money coming out of there. By this time, Lefty's set up a whole bunch of different corrupt employees to start a regular flow of money skimmed from the four casinos owned by the Argent Corporation. And that money will be divided between Chicago, Milwaukee, Cleveland, and Kansas City. They're the ones that put the pressure on the Teamsters Pension Loan Fund to loan the money. So listen to what retired Gaming Board investigator Jack Miller has to say about skimming.
What skimming is, basically, is the removal of pre-taxed or money that have not been taxed. And Nevada lives on its taxes like every other state does. At the Stardust, there was the first skim that I was aware of was the estimated $21 million slot scam. They estimated that over a period of 3 years, the mob got $21 million. And the way they did that, the estimation, is they went back and looked at records of other similar casinos, saw what their drops were, and then compared the two, because it's the only way they could find to get close.
$21 million, Aaron. What do you think about that? Where did it all go?
In three years. That's a lot of sandwiches.
That is.
When you think that they're wearing a sports coat with $30,000 in one inner pocket and $30,000 in the other, I hope those guys got frequent flyer miles.
Well, that was actually before this. This was the first iteration of the skim before they started taking the cash out and bringing it back in the pockets of the coats. This was the slot skim. You know how they complained about the money and the silver dollars and how heavy it was.
Yeah, you can't. It's easy to. That's part of the intro to the actual program. I had cut that together. How these guys are talking about. You can't get $3,000 in coins out of the casino like you can get $3,000 in cash out. And what are they going to do? They set up their own bank inside the casino. Cost them $50,000. And there's a great line you can hear where the guy's like, "Do it."
So they. This was part of that. This was the early, the first slot. Skimming scheme. They later on they just started taking it out of the count room. Carl Thomas came up with that idea, just take it straight out of the count room before it's counted. But at this point in time, they rigged the scales. They weighed the coins.
Well, if you had $1,000 in coins, because they had so many coins, there was no way they could physically count them.
Right.
Unless they had some kind of counting machine, but rather they just figured what the weight of a certain amount of coins was, and they could shovel all of these coins onto the scale.
Right.
And so if you would think the scale would be, a little light such that when it was set at zero, it would actually be less.
It would be, minus 10.
So yeah.
You could skim off 10 pounds and nobody would ever know it. It would never get counted. Cause that's the deal. You got to get it before it's counted. And then they count it. And then, like you said, they'd have to set up another bank and put those coins in there and get cash out of there. Which was all kind of a pain.
There's an interesting thing. And again, he had to go back and listen to the two-part interview with Frank Culotta, where Frank talks about somebody coming out of the count room recognizing him.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not supposed to really know each other or talk about this stuff.
Right.
Let's just pretend like it never happened.
One day I was standing by the count room, the cage, and I seen this little old guy picking up the boxes and back all the tables and bringing him into the count room, and the guard was standing on the outside. He wasn't allowed in there. And then the guy come out, he spotted me. And he said, "Hey, Frankie, how you doing?" I said, "Good." I said, "Wait, well, when did you get a job here?" You know, he was connected. He was married to somebody that was a boss in the Chicago office. And he says, "Well, I've been here for about a couple of years, you know." He says, "I'm the only one that could go in the count room, not even the hack, meaning the cop." So I told him, "Listen, do me a favor, you know. I said, don't tell anybody you told me that, all right? And I won't tell nobody you told me that." I said, "Because we'll both be in fucking trouble." I said, "So keep that under your head." "I said, well, I know you're part." I said, "No, but I don't want to know that stuff. You know what I mean? Because now I know something that I didn't want to know, all right? But I knew the skim was going on. I just didn't know who was the guy that was able to go in that room, you know."
This is about the point in time when Tony Splatro has asked Frank Culotta to come out there.
Yeah, he was out there to make sure, more or less to protect Lefty, and to Lefty was sort of a flamboyant guy, and sort of like to keep him in check. But Lefty was such a loose cannon, and he loved notoriety so much that Tony had to stay away from him. So Tony assigned another guy to hang around with him, and the guy was from New York. And that sort of kept the heat off of Chicago by putting somebody else from another city to hang around with him, and he would report back to Tony.
And that guy was a guy named Joey Cusimano, who actually had they gave him some kind of a job at Stardust. He was there all the time. And he kept a low profile. Nobody ever really connected him up to the mob during those years. He would eventually be the victim of a contract killing or a hit of some kind a few years, I'd say maybe on up in the later 80s. I don't know if anybody really ever knew what the whole story was with Joey Cusimano. They called him the car dealer on the wiretaps. Never could figure out the reason why they called him the car dealer, but that was who that was, Joey Cusimano. Now, the outfit doesn't really pay somebody like Splatro, like a case sum to go out there and watch over the skim. They're just supposed to do it because you're a member of the outfit. They don't pay a guy like Culotta a salary just for, you know, going out there and watching Lefty's back. And, you know, if Lefty needed any, you know, needed a dealer was stealing from him or something, or somebody, they're afraid somebody was going to go to the cops or they had card cheats coming in. You wanted them roughed up a little bit. Use any kind of strong arm tactics as those guys were capable of. They don't really give you a regular salary. What they really gave, what the outfit gave Splatro was a license to steal in Las Vegas. And working for the outfit is not like a normal job. If not like they gave Tony Spilotro a franchise and he could display a sign that he's a well-connected guy. But what he could do is he can go around and start extracting a street tax from other criminals in town. He could just start conducting their own illicit activity. You know, there's Jimmy the Weasel Fratiano. He was, he came in, one of the earlier guys, the higher level guys that came in, and he was pretty intimately familiar with IUPA, because he came up in Cleveland and then he transferred his membership in the mob out to Los Angeles. So he was really, being that close to Las Vegas, he knew a lot about what was going on and went back and forth with, to Chicago and Cleveland. He had some comments about, Spilotro and what he was doing out there and what he thought about him.
Spilotro got Johnny Roselli's old job in Vegas, you know. Johnny knew diplomacy. He handled it smooth, arbitrating beefs, just like they did in the old days, you know. But Spilotro, he's doing things that Roselli never would do. He's got juice loans on the street. He's got a crew of burglars working in and around Vegas. He's supposed to be a watchdog for IUPA, but this guy's like the watchdog that got under the fence. You know, he's an animal, a punk with no class. And now I hear he's running around, you know, acting really tough.
By 1979, Tony has got Frank Culotta out there. He's living out there. Frank would say that he was fed up with Chicago anyhow. He was tired of the crooked cops and always wanting to take a chunk of his money anytime they found out he had a score. And the good cops and the feds were wanting to put him in jail because they were, I tell you, by the late 70s, they were all over the outfit guys in Chicago, just like we were here in Kansas City. So he accepted Spilotro's invitation to join his crew out there. He was putting together a crew. When Frank arrived, he said that Spilotro told him he wanted Frank to be in charge of this crew, put a crew of Chicago guys together, and Frank to kind of be in charge of it and start doing jobs. He also kind of wanted him to be his inside guy at the casino if he wanted something that just he wanted to get done, that he didn't want this Cusimano to know about, that he didn't want reported back to Chicago, that he didn't want Lefty to know about particularly. But he did tell Lefty who Culotta was and that he ought to take care of him when he's out there. Because I think by this time, by 1979, Spilotro was in the black book, so he couldn't even go inside of one of the casinos out there.
No, Tony, since we're about 12 years old, we grew up together. At the end of 78, I moved out to Las Vegas, and on his request to watch his back, you know, be his underboss, more or less. That's the term they use, the underboss. So that's what I was noted for, the underboss and the leader of the hole-in-the-wall gang.
Well, gaming enforcement, when Spilotro and all those guys got out there, was not the most professional in the world. And law enforcement in general was not the most professional in the world out there. It was real kind of Western sheriff, cowboy-like, and just a little bit corrupt. These guys didn't really understand who these mob guys were that came out there. They knew what criminals were, but they didn't understand the sophistication of the skimming. They knew about, you know, burglaries and robberies and murders, things like that, but they didn't understand the more sophisticated crimes that they would do. All the gaming background investigations were conducted by Clark County Sheriff's Office. The sheriff was Ralph Lamb at the time. And they weren't, you know, he didn't hire the most professional guys. He was an old school Western style lawman who ran a large family ranch as well as serving as sheriff. He was, his brother were both had been kind of politicians, and I think their dad was. They were compared to the Chicago outfit guys, they were a little bit backwoodsy, but they were tough. He was known to meet lower level mobsters at the airport and rough them up a little bit and tell them to go on back home. Even when he bragged that Chicago outfit mobster Johnny Roselli, who I think, Jimmy the Weasel mentioned Johnny Roselli because he was the, Chicago outfit's, kind of mob liaison for the western part of the United States up until Spilotro came out. And he bragged that he grabbed Johnny Roselli and slapped the cologne off of him once. So that's the kind of guy he was.
Well, these guys, they didn't care. They were in charge. They were the lawmen. They didn't care that these guys were from Chicago, did they then? It was kind of like, you know, remember the movie L.A. Confidential?
Yeah.
And they just, you know, they're going to use tactics that are outside the scope of the law.
Yeah. What they felt like a professional criminal would respond to was, you know, whacking them around a little bit. What they didn't understand was the sophistication of it. So you whack me around, and I say, okay, you whack me around, and I go on and set up a burglar crew and start doing high-end burglaries at, late at night where I can, you know, go around alarms and have people that will, you know, not rat me out and have a way to fence the stuff back east and outside of Las Vegas and steal and set up skimming operations at casinos and do loan sharking and bookmaking and those kinds of things. Although they probably didn't have to, didn't do bookmaking in Las Vegas. You could just go to this casino to make a sports bet.
Well, I think it's interesting, you know, because it seems like it would be good money for them to be able to go and find other criminals and, you know, rough them up and take part of their cut. Because the criminal's not going to run to the cops and tell them.
Right.
Well, I was robbing this place and these other guys came along and they took half my loot.
Yeah. And that's what mob guys do is they rob other criminals that aren't protected by some mob member.
Yeah. But when you slap their cologne off them, now that's,
yeah, that's enough.
That's too far.
Here's another thing he did. He had a large group of Hell's Angels coming into Las Vegas. So he got a whole bunch of his sheriff's deputies out there, and they destroyed several motorcycles, and they grabbed two or three of the bikers with real long hair, and they gave them haircuts and then turned them loose. So he was that kind of guy. He was a piece of work. He actually once wrote a character reference letter attesting to the good character of Lefty Rosenthal in support for Lefty to get a license to be involved with in the Florida racetrack industry. I think maybe to own a racehorse down there, you had to have a background check. So, you know, he was... Like I said, I just don't think he understood the ramifications of the mob. He understood Hell's Angels. He understood low-level mobsters, and he understood, you know, crimes that he could stumble across, but he didn't understand how sophisticated somebody like Lefty was.
Well, who did the gaming licenses in Nevada? At that time.
At that time, it was his office. Now, eventually, that will be taken away from his office because it's a huge responsibility. And plus, it opens your background investigators up for potential corruption. You'd have to pay them well, and you'd have to pay attention to what they were doing and who they were approving. And believe me, these background investigations, I went through one for the Missouri Gaming board to have a contract job with them for a while, and they really intrude in every area of your life and talk to people and find out everything they can about you. But when you got the sheriff's office doing it, who has one some good old boy hired, and they give him a job to go do that, and he didn't really care that much, and he's not sophisticated about modern day organized crime and making those kinds of connections.
Well, this is the 1970s. They can't get online.
And they can't get online. They got to depend on other police departments if somebody came in from out of state. And at this point in time, the Nevada officials out there, it was a wild west. They resented any intrusion into their jurisdiction, especially by the federal government. They had more like what you would call a libertarian attitude against anything regarding the central government. If they did it, it was okay. But if the central government comes in and wants to do something, it's not so okay. And they did not play well with the FBI or the U.S. Attorney's Office. That's for sure. Well, it's the middle of the 1970s and later 1970s, and Nevada's changing. They're getting a little more sophisticated, and they realize, and somebody's starting to realize, that Chicago and other Eastern organized crime families or Midwest organized crime families are infiltrating their casinos. Informants are telling them about the skimming, the loss of thousands of dollars in tax revenue because the money's being skimmed off before it's counted.
Well, those weren't very good informants if all they were saying was thousands of dollars.
Well, you know, that's probably just something I wrote down here.
Yeah, you're like, it's millions of dollars.
Millions of dollars. Yeah, we just heard about what?
$3 million.
And,
these guys were just going full tilt by that time.
Ralph Lamb ends up being charged with income tax evasion. He'll eventually be found not guilty, but bad publicity cost him the election in 1979. Now, during this time, the Las Vegas City Police Department and the Clark County Sheriff's Office had merged in order to, save time and money on administrative costs and that kind of thing. We did that over here in Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas. It's now known as the Las Vegas Metro PD. And a former Las Vegas Police Department sergeant named John McCarthy, or maybe he was a lieutenant. I think he was a lieutenant by the time he ran for sheriff. But anyhow, John McCarthy ran for election, or ran for sheriff's office, and he got elected.
McCarthy came in and won the election. And he had a couple of campaign promises. One was there was a terrible problem with prostitution in Las Vegas at the time. And people couldn't walk on the strip with their wives without prostitutes confronting them and trying to pull the man away from his wife and lure him into a hotel room, sometimes inviting the wife along, as a matter of fact. And the other was the organized crime situation, primarily the Tony Spilotro, what they call the Tony Spilotro problem here.
So that was Denny Griffin. He wrote a book. He actually co-wrote with Frank Collada several books about his life and times, and he also wrote a book called The Battle for Las Vegas. It's probably one of the better books about this time period. And during this time, just before John McCarthy was elected, the Metro, and they've changed to the from the Sheriff's Department and the City Police Department to the Metro, Las Vegas Metro Police Department. The Metro Vice and Narcotics Unit had been neglected and was infused with corruption. Infused, that's not a very good word, infested with corruption. McCarthy will promote a former vice officer who was known to be incorruptible in a sea of corruption. He was an untouchable. Kent Clifford, I met him. He's now deceased. And he is that kind of guy, and I was able to interview him during his life. Let's listen a little bit what the Las Vegas Elliot Ness had to say about the police being tainted out there.
Was Clark County at the time, when Sheriff Lamb was in there, he kept that close to him. He wanted to investigate for Clark County gaming license and a Clark County liquor license and a business license, okay? He all had all that under his fingers. That meant more, okay? When McCarthy got in there, he didn't like that because that's how the Intelligence Bureau got tainted, because they knew what was going on. So they had power over business license. They had power over gaming license. They had power over liquor license. So you can imagine what a corrupt power could do to that. So he said, Kent, I don't want to investigate gaming licenses. And I said, well, that's fine, because I don't have time for that anyway. We're working your intelligence bureau. We'll continue to investigate liquor licenses and the business license as a normal course of business. But we're not going to
investigate gaming licenses. Cut that interview off a little bit. So Kent Clifford takes over. He takes over what's called the Intelligence Unit, which works on organized crime, just like it does here in Kansas City, where I worked for 13 years. And at that period in time, there was the National Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit organizations, which all major police departments and state patrols have a are members of this organization. It's kind of like Interpol in that it keeps a book, and it has a designated representative in each one of these departments. And if I need to know something in Las Vegas, I will call the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit designated person or the LEIU person. And just like if they want something in Kansas City, why, they'll call me. Or they'll call whoever, they'll call my sergeant. Actually, back then, I think it was Sergeant Wisher was the LEIU representative. Then he'll, assign it to one of his detectives. He'd assign it to me. At this point in time, they kicked out the Las Vegas Police Department because of a particular person. The FBI refused to work with the Las Vegas Metro Intelligence Unit in any manner, because a member of that intelligence unit at this point in time, a guy named Joe Blasco, was working for Tony Spilotro at the same time. And in 1978, local FBI agents overheard Joe Blasco and another vice and narcotics officer giving Tony Spilotro information on a wiretap that they knew it found out about that the feds tried to put on Spilotro. Both of them were later indicted and fired from the police department. I think maybe even before Kent Clifford got there, Joe Blasco was gone. But a lot of the other guys, when he walked in the door, who were contemporaries, shall we say, of Joe Blasco, were there when Kent Clifford got there.
I'm just guessing that when Joe Blasco talked to Tony to tell him about these wiretaps, he was at least smart enough not to call him.
Well, FBI agents overheard him on another wiretap or a hidden microphone. I'm not sure which, but I think it might have been on a hidden microphone.
Yeah, they need to go for one of those walks where they cover their mouths.
Really,
but they couldn't do that either because then they'd get the photos of them.
Doing the Charlie Brown code. If anybody's seen my Ben Ellickson-inspired mafia video, I need to put that back up on Facebook. It's funny. There's an FBI agent out there named Emmett Michaels. This guy is, he is Mr. Law Enforcement. He's blunt, straightforward, hard charging. Looks like a former linebacker for the Chicago Bears.
For the first year, we did a bunch of groundwork, you know, figuring out who was who was Tony Spilotro, who was the people he was running with. A lot of it had been already on paper. We decided to take it a step further. We knew Tony and some of the Metropolitan Police Department were taking photographs of agents as they come out of the federal building. So before any more of the agents arrived, we decided to set up an offsite where the agents wouldn't even come in. They wouldn't even be recognized. I was the surveillance tech supervisor, so we had you know, several locations in town where we operated out of.
So anyhow, Emmett Michaels had been transferred out to Las Vegas from back east, and he's assigned to lead a Tony Spilotro dedicated surveillance squad. That's, they put together a special squad, and they called it the Spilotro Surveillance Squad, basically. And he told me a little bit about how the Metro police culture changed after they got the new Sheriff McCarthy in.
Joe Yablotsky, who was the SAC here, made a statement one day that we have to replant the American flag, which is really true. These people thought they were above and beyond. They thought they were an independent colony. Eventually, Sheriff McCarthy won the election. He brought in his crew, brought in a new crew, Kent Clifford, who was the intelligence officer.
My friend Kent Clifford gets in. He's given a directive to clean up this corrupt unit.
He put me in as commander of the Intelligence Bureau to clean it up. I actually took over the 20th of December of 1978. One day before Christmas, I walked into my office and there was 40 or 50 cases of hard liquor. Where did this come from? We get this every year. I said, what do you mean you get this every year? He said, the Strip contributes this for our Christmas every year. And I said, get rid of it, and this is the last year that will ever happen.
So just the one little thing is doing away with the freebies from all the casinos was a start. And what he's doing there, Aaron, and that's how you do that if you're a new sergeant or commander, lieutenant, captain, whatever, taking over a unit, first thing you do is find some of the most obvious problems and deal with them directly. Say, you know, this is not happening anymore. Now get rid of that shit. And I'm not putting up with this, which sends a message. And he continued to work. And then he had to start working on individual guys.
We had had one detective from the Intelligence Bureau defect and go over to the Chicago mob or Tony Spilotro and work for Tony Spilotro. So he was fired previous to our election. And when I had personal knowledge of some of them,
that were working the strip and taking gold jewelry and coats and other things for their production out on the strip, or lack of production, whatever it was. And I decided I needed to transfer everybody out. Everybody was in the Intelligence Bureau needed to leave because they was tainted, if nothing else, but those kind of gifts. So I transferred everybody out and brought all new people in that I had known from narcotics and vice and other people that were investigators.
1979, after Kent's taken over the unit, he's starting to clean it up. The FBI and the Las Vegas Metro Intelligence Unit are starting to work together again. They developed a little bit of a trust. Frank Culotta's putting together a bunch of his old outfit comrades and some other burglars and a burglar gang and started doing burglaries. And they got that name, understand, I think, maybe even Frank told us this. Every time they went to do a decent burglary, they found that alarm companies had wired up the doors and the windows, so they started knocking a hole in the wall. Just like Spilotro and Culotta did back in 1957 in that first bank job. I was kind of interested that the very first bank job I could find anything about, they knocked a hole in the wall. So they're still knocking holes in the wall to avoid those alarms. They didn't have motion detectors. They'll hit houses and businesses all over the Southwest. They don't just stay in Las Vegas. They go down to Phoenix and Tucson and over into California and any place they can, get a tipster to tell them that this would be a good score and get a little bit of, know a little bit about the place and what might be in there. Tony Spilotro set a lot of those up, from contacts he had. They each had their own contacts. They had contacts in the casinos. They'd find out about drug dealers who had a lot of money. They'd go hit them and strong arm them. They'd find out about other criminals doing things that might have made a nice score. They could find out about it. They'd hit them and then they'd have to give the tipster back a little piece of the money. And they'd have like cocktail waitresses talk about somebody that had won a shitload of money in a casino and they knew, and they could go
hit them in their hotel room,
hit their hotel room when they were out. Cause they had people who are really good with, alarms and lock picks. And it was a really professional, gang that they put together. They tried not to confront anybody. So that, cause that, you know, goes from burglary to robbery, and the sentencing for and the attention the press gives, a burglary is a whole lot less than they do for a robbery. And especially if somebody accidentally gets hurt. Now, during this time, Tony Spilotro will order Frank Culotta to murder a guy, a Las Vegas resident named Jerry Lisner. He thinks that Lisner's an informant. We're just kind of talking about this to show this is the kind of control that Spilotro had over Culotta and the Hole in the Wall gang. Because Frank will take another member of the Hole in the Wall gang, Wayne Matecki, with him to back him up on the hit.
As soon as I got back, Tony said, well, you got to kill him now real quick. And then a week went by, and Tony was getting real nervous. Come on, you got to do it. You got to do it right away, or else I'll go do it. So then a couple days later, I was able to get it together and go and kill this guy. And the guy was very difficult. He didn't want to die. Nobody really wants to die, but I shot him in the head 6 times, and he was still alive. So, fortunately, the guy in the car that was listening to the radio, police radios, came in the house with reloads.
That's when he shot him again.
Yeah, he used up all the bullets in his gun, and he was out. The guy's not dead. Now he's got to get some extra rounds, because they're probably self-loaded again.
Yeah,
They're all loading their own rounds.
Yep. And this is the scene in Casino, if you remember that, Aaron. We talked about this before, too, so I don't want to bore you guys that are regular fans, but this is the scene in Casino where the hitman chases a guy all through the house and ends up in the swimming pool trying to kill him. It seemed like part of that really happened. You need to go back and listen to my our Frank Culotta interview.
I think Frank said the guy wouldn't fucking die.
Yeah, that's what he just said. He gives a lot more. Oh, this is the scene in the movie that Scorsese is saying, you know, this isn't right. It's just not, I don't like this. And Culotta's sitting there on set as the technical advisor. And he says, well, I'll tell you what, said, that ain't the way it happened. You know, I did it the way it happened. He said, well, who are you? What do you know? He said, well, I'm the one that did it. So he said, get that man a costume. And he ended up playing himself in the movie as the hitman.
Well, Frank and his crew, they had a cover as well. Like, Tony had a gift shop at Circus Circus. Right. Frank, he had the Upper Crust.
Yeah, the Upper Crust. And then right next to it was a bar called the other place, I think. We'll get into that more into that later. But he had a bar and a restaurant in Las Vegas. And at this point in time, Las Vegas Metro Intelligence got this incorruptible new commander. He's transferring in a lot of young, aggressive police officers. He's creating a partnership with Emmett Michaels and Las Vegas FBI that they didn't have before, and have a task force going. And Blotto Task Force will focus their attention on the Upper Crust because that's where these guys all go to hang out. I know every one of you as a Mub fan has seen that famous picture of Frank Culotta and the Hole in the Wall gang sitting out in front of the Upper Crust. Look like Tony Soprano and his crew sitting out in front of the butcher shop. Well, these guys are all sitting out in front of the pizza place. The focus on the Upper Crust will lead to some disastrous consequences for one Chicago outfit hanger on, and it'll also lead to a confrontation between Kent Clifford and the entire hierarchy of the Chicago outfit back in Chicago. That we're going to deal with that next time. At this point in time, the national newspapers are starting to take notice of the presence of Tony Spilotro out there. The local police and media are onto him, so everybody's watching him. He's got Culotta kind of undercover a little bit, doing things in the casino, and he's got this Joey Cusimano that he stays away from, except via the telephone, or maybe a really secret meeting with him, to deal with anything in the casino. The Wall Street Journal even prints an article that names Iupa and Spilotro as the two men behind a strong move out west by the Chicago outfit. And I've got a wiretapper, actually. It's a hidden microphone, and Joe Gusto or Tuffy DeLuna is reading that article to Nick Savella, and he just ends up saying, oh boy. And then the wiretap or the microphone was shut off. Tony Spilotro's given up his gift shop in the Circus Circus after the Gaming Control Board and discovered his ties back to the Chicago outfit. He's been put in a black book, but he opens another jewelry store called the Gold Rush, a block off the strip.
This was, if you go back and listen to the two-part interview with Frank Culotta, he talks about how there was a bank across the street from the Upper Crust pizza restaurant, and a bank teller comes over and tells them how there's people in the bank or up on another floor taking photos of them.
Oh, yeah, that's right. People are always ratting you out when you do things like that.
And then, we start finding out where Tony was hanging out, what time he'd move. So we got his pattern down pretty much. He had the restaurant hangout bar over there on Maryland Parkway.
Okay, good.
Anyhow, we were able to select a building that we were able to set up cameras and things of this nature, but we wanted to get inside and put in mics because they used to meet in the back room.
He uses the Gold Rush to friend's stolen goods obtained by the Hole in the Wall gang. Police intelligence units in other cities with the FBI, Milwaukee, Chicago, Cleveland, Kansas City, will serve search warrants on mob leaders and uncover evidence of the Vegas skimming activities. The FBI and Las Vegas Metro Police are starting to tighten the noose on Spilotro and his Hole in the Wall gang, and got heavy, heavy surveillance, both the audio, video, and physical surveillance on the Gold Rush and on Culotta's Upper Crust restaurant. But the gang's still making money, and they're still attracting law enforcement heat, of course. And in the next episode, Aaron and I will look at the events leading up to the big score at Bertha's Gifts. And the next year or so will not be without incident, now that we're in 1979 to 80, and the Bertha's is not till 81. There was going to be several incidents. We'll hear a lot about successes and failures and what I call WTF situations. All this time, Spilotro's Hole in the Wall gang are doing burglaries and they're loan sharking. The upper echelon in Kansas City and Chicago are still getting money out of the casinos. They just had to shift it a little bit. We'll end with this clip about plotting skimming from Vegas casinos. between Kansas City mob boss Nick Civella and one of his underlings who worked at the Tropicana, Joe Augusto, and a Tropicana casino executive named Carl Thomas.
He's going to say, instead of getting the cash out of the box, whatever that means,
not in the money box,
yeah, why can't you get them out of the bank, out of the guy who got the chips?
No, the cashier is our cashier, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We get
out of the bank, but let me finish my thought, maybe it's wrong. The chips stayed there. So the cashier is 75 on the loan.
Cage is over, right?
The cage is over. So he's standing and going through the boxes, and what he required to take away the right of the controlling to have absolute control of those people, the accounting office. Forget about the box. Just taking them out of the cage. That's what we've done in the past, Joe. We can keep doing that. We may have to go to that, but the bad thing about it, it's a messy way to do it. Because it's a record of a film.
It was February 14th of 79 when they, across the country in Milwaukee and Chicago and Kansas City, right in Cleveland, raided these various homes, businesses, or whatever, residents of these mob figures for skimming in Vegas based on the wiretaps. But they never took down Spilotro or Culotta, even though they were kind of part of that.
Right.
They left them out there. And of course, those guys probably had to pretty instantly become aware of what had happened, as there would be communication about it. But then here they are, still just doing the same stuff. I mean, I guess they're like, well, that's my job. I got to make money. What am I going to do? The upper crust, you know, it's not like they were going out stealing pizzas and reselling them. At least the gold rush made sense. They could go steal a bunch of jewelry and put it in their jewelry store to sell it.
Yeah. Well, the upper crust was just a hangout, just a place to meet. They said they
it was their social club.
Social club. Yeah. It was their social club. And you know, the skimming was still going on. It was just through different people.
They never had yet to discover the scales were weighted.
That already happened a long time ago. Okay. Now they have to, identify and take out all the, deep throat employees who are facilitating
or participating in the
skimming. And they know some of them. They know Carl Thomas by this point in time. They know a couple others, but still, everybody has a right to due process. So over the next year, the FBI starts calling people in and taking interviews and trying to turn people. They end up turning Joe Augusto. They turn a couple of other smaller fry people, and they slowly but surely put together a case. They keep taking all this evidence to a grand jury, playing some of the wiretaps, getting people to turn and explaining the wiretaps, getting Alan Glick to turn and testify. So it takes another year and a half, 2 years before they can actually put together enough to indict all these people. So they just keep operating.
Yeah.
Until the indictments go together. It's not like TV. It happens in an hour.
And once they get an indictment, they bring them in the courtroom, they get in, and they bail themselves out because they've got all that money, and they go back and they continue to do the same operation.
Yeah, it's still going. And they just get some different people in there. They even got a new casino owner of the Stardust, a guy named Al Sachs, S-A-C-H-S. And it turns out, a couple, 3 years later, they finally catch him skimming and boot him out. And then the Stardust is sold to somebody completely different, and they split up all four of those casinos, I believe, and it finally started turning around then after he left the casino. And then after by the 83, when the trials were, after those trials were over and all those mob heads went to jail, why, that was kind of the end of it. And he took the Teamsters, controlled the Teamsters union away from the Midwest mobs, and Alan Dorfman went away. They killed him.
Yeah,
actually.
I was going to say, Alan Dorfman ended up dead. Lefty Rosenthal, though.
Lefty Rosenthal goes into hiding because it's starting to come out he's an informant. So they try to blow him up, and he's in hiding. The skimming's still going on, and these guys still got, they're all out there. They still got to earn a living. They still got to do burglaries and make scores and steal from drug dealers. And
yeah, they got to pay for their extravagant lifestyle.
Extort money from people. Things like that. So
it's not cheap to stay and live in Vegas.
No, it's not. Having said all that, if you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all. Gangland Wire, available for rent or purchase on Amazon. And then after you're done watching that, you're going to want to know more. And there's more to know. And Gary is the guy to go to get it. So you're going to want to go out and get Gary's book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And when you're done reading that, you're going to want to hear it because Gary has a Kindle version for all of you high-tech folks out there that want to listen to the words from the mouth of the men that did it. With the Kindle version, there's hyperlinks to actual audio from the mouth of the men with a transcription. So not only can you hear them say it, you can read what they're saying to understand, because Joe Augusto and these guys, not always easy to understand.
Yeah.
And then if that's not enough, you're going to come to Kansas City to learn more, and you're going to want to get the Kansas City Mob Tour. For $1.99, you can take your own turn-by-turn tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.